This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
We're talking today on Keeping the Faith with Mike Doyle, who is the very brand new executive director of the University YMCA at the University of Illinois campus. Welcome, Mike.
It's glad to be here.
And I said we. Usually I say I am talking with, but today I have someone else to introduce. So this show suddenly has an intern. We're so excited. And Carly Nix is in the studio with us. Carly, welcome to you.
Hi, thanks. I'm glad to be here.
Carly is a very recent graduate of Boston University. And before that, she grew up in Decatur and went to the math and science high school here in the state, so we know how smart she is. Good to have her as an intern for the show. She was a religion major with a journalism minor at Boston, so we're delighted to have her, and she'll be part of the show in weeks ahead. You may hear her voice even more than occasionally. But getting to Mike Doyle, who's our special guest, and I've looked forward to for this this show for a while because, of course, I was the director at the Y for the last 9 years, and then for the last 6 months, Willard Broom has been an interim director, and we're both delighted to have you full time starting tomorrow. I guess.
Right, exactly. Well, I have big shoes to fill because the organization's wonderful, but you've done a great job in your leadership, so I appreciate that.
Well, you'll find out more, some of which will be negative as you learn more, but that's fine. We'll put that off. Tell us how you got to this. What have you been doing most recently?
Well, I'm stepping down as executive director of Community Shares of Illinois, which is a federation of about 80 nonprofit organizations, a social action fund that raises money and provides support for organizations largely through workplace giving. So locally, it's organizations like the Habitat for Humanity, Champaign County Healthcare Consumers, and 80 groups statewide.
Now, you've been the director of that, but weren't you also one of the creators of it, one of the founders?
I was, yes. I was executive director at the Champaign County Healthcare Consumers, and we were talking about the need to build support for the organization, and workplace giving was one of the options that we started looking into and realized that not just doing it as one organization, but pulling together other groups was the most logical way to do it. And learned from another of organizations around the country who had done that recently, and so we began working on it. And that was back in 91.
Now, when you came up with that idea in 1991, how did you see a need for this as opposed to, say, United Way, which also does workplace giving
sure.
and so forth?
Yeah, United Way has pioneered that. United Way has a set of usually human service agencies, so there are some organizations that don't fall into the United Way rubric. You know, organizations that I was working with were advocacy organizations organizing, so they weren't providing services, so it didn't really fall into the area that United Way was funding. So for us, it was figuring out how do we do that. We had tried some efforts on getting people to write us in on the United Way pledge cards, and it didn't go that well. So when we looked around the country, what we learned is that there was a number of social action funds that had been started around the country and were very successful at that.
So what are the limits under community shares for people who may not know about that option as one of the ways that they can give to organizations they care about? What are the limits? Can a group apply to be part of community shares that, for example, does lobbying?
Absolutely. I mean, they have to be a 501c3 organization, and so there are certain limits on organizations that have that tax-exempt status. A lot of lobbying groups are 501c4, but there are, for example, the Illinois National Organization for Women does some lobbying, but it has an education fund, and that's what people are able to support through this if they support Illinois Now, things like that. So you have groups like the League of Women Voters, who's been a member of Community Shares. They may be doing some lobbying, but they meet the 501c3 criteria, so they're eligible for receiving those contributions.
Let me give the phone number so that listeners may join this conversation and ask questions of our guest, Mike Doyle. In Champaign-Urbana, the number is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL, the call letters of the station, of course. If you're listening and it's a long-distance call, use 1-800 1-800-222-9455. So a toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455, and Champaign-Urbana 333-9455. Tell us some other organizations that are part of Community Shares of Illinois.
Sure. Again, there's 80 of them, so we have a number of statewide organizations like the Illinois Hunger Coalition, the Coalition of Citizens with Disabilities. So you have a number of those groups, the NAACP. Then there are local groups, and again, here in Champaign, Champaign County Healthcare Consumers, which I was involved in for a number of years, does health advocacy work. They're involved in some issues concerning toxic waste disposal in the north end of Champaign. So they address a broad range of health-related issues. There's groups like Homestead Corporation, which builds low-income housing here in town, Habitat for Humanity, Champaign-Urbana Tenant Union, which does advocacy for students and tenants. The Humane Society is a member that just joined a couple of years ago. And then this year, the Wesley Evening Food Pantry is becoming a member, and the Junior League of Champaign-Urbana is also new members this year.
So tell us how it works. How do you let people know how to give money through Community Shares for organizations that they might care about?
Sure. Well, the first thing for us is to be an option in the workplace. So some of our work focuses on educating employers about the value of expanding the choices. There's a lot of organizations, employers will have United Way as an option, but there's a number of other good groups that organizations that individuals want to support. So that's one of our challenges is educating employers and talking to them. So a number of them, University of Illinois, most of the public employers in Champaign County offer Community Shares as one of the options. And increasingly, we're finding private employers. This year, we were included in Provena's workplace campaign, Human Kinetics, Champaign Telephone. So we help get the word out in terms of that. Once it's in the workplace campaign, then it's really trying to educate the employees about the work we do. Some employers allow you to come out and speak at staff meetings, talk about the work of your organizations, what they're doing. We try and get the word out publicly in the fall campaign through different kinds of events, but also just in terms of getting on radio talk shows. We do some sponsorship, things like that.
And do people give the money to Community Shares and then it gets passed through to the other organizations, or do they designate it for –
well,
do you decide where the money goes out
right,
of the total
well,
pot, or how's that?
Right. Done? Well, there's different models. The model we use is slightly different from United Way. We encourage designations to our organization. So we encourage people to pick the groups. There's 80 of them. Some can give – you can give to all 80 if you want to, but if you want to pick out four or five. So our – one of our focuses is encouraging people to pick the organization that they want to support. But about a third of the money that we get is actually people not making a designation. They're sort of look at the list and say, hey, I support you all. We just want to support Community Shares and your members. That money gets divided up among our members on a sweat equity program that they developed. So the more they volunteer and get involved in the organization, identify new employers, they earn some sweat equity. And at the end of each year, we sort of divide up that pot of money that's donated among our members based on how they're involved in the organization. Good. We're fairly small, and so we really need the volunteer support of our member groups to make it work.
And if someone designates that they want the money they give to go to, say, one organization, say, Healthcare Consumers,
right.
There are expenses for your operation to,
sure.
to continue. How much of a cut do you take out of what they designate?
15% goes to Community Shares administrative processing fee, and that goes for paying for a lot of things. It actually is only a small percentage of our operating budget. It's probably about 20% of our operating budget actually comes from that. Most of the money that runs the organization is through other ways that we raise it. We have a fundraiser every year called Share Meal that's coming up on March 10th where local restaurants participating. People who come and eat there that night, between 20 and 30% of the money donated, the restaurant gets to pick the percentage, goes to Community Shares, or they can also designate to some of our member groups.
We have our first caller for the afternoon on our toll-free line, line number 4. Yes, you're on the air with our guest, Mike Doyles. Go right ahead.
Hello. Not to zero in on one special thing, but I guess that's what I'm doing here. national health care, single payer, cut out the insurance companies, obviously the lobbyists in Congress are totally influencing them, totally out of whack with the percentage of people in the populace that want to have national health care. I'll just hang up and let you comment on that. Thank you.
Thank you for raising the issue.
Well, you know, I've spent a lot of my life organizing around healthcare reform, organizing at the grassroots level. I mentioned the Champaign County Healthcare Consumers before. So I'm a big proponent of a single-payer healthcare program. I think that's really the best solution for the country. But I'm also, and in the work I've done over the years, a realistic about what's possible. So we have to push and shoot for what we think is the best situation. But the reality is change comes slowly, and it comes in steps. So I think for the first time in a long time, and I have to preface this by saying in 1991, 92, right around the time Clinton got elected, the local newspaper said, they asked people, what do you think is going to happen in the next 8 years when we go into the next century? And I said, well, I think the one thing I do know after 15 years of being involved in healthcare, no, yeah, 15 years, is that we'll have national healthcare by the end of the the end of the decade, the end of the century. So that's one thing I felt very confident that we would have. So here I am.
So you may not be a prophet.
Exactly. My track record is not so good. But I think there was an opportunity then. It didn't work. There's another opportunity right now. And sometimes crisis provides the opportunity to do some stuff that otherwise doesn't come along. So I'm hopeful. I think it's going to happen. I won't be so bold as to predict when. So I think that's something that's coming. The last thing I want to say on it is I think, you know, President Obama, the first time I met him, he was speaking here in Champaign County, and he came through, and he was running for the Senate in the primary, and I knew his he was sort of the progressive, as I thought of it, in the group. But he didn't look like he had much of a chance, and he was walking down the aisle, and I went up and shook his hand, and as a health advocate, I thought I'll start out with an easy question. I said, so you support single-payer, Senator? I mean, yeah, he was a senator at the time. And would you be supporting that there? And he says, well, to tell you the truth, I don't support single-payer. And here I am. I was in some ways weird because his charisma allowed him to say that. He was upfront, straightforward about it, and said, you know, we've got to be practical about what we can get, and I want to get it done. So I thought it was very interesting. It wasn't what I expected to hear. I think that's how he will be as president, and I think it's incumbent on those of us, the caller, and the rest of us who care about this, to really try and engage the president, because I think he's willing to go somewhere, but he's going to do what's realizable.
So you said you're interested in realistic goals. What do you think are some reasonable goals that we can expect or try to shoot for in the next few years?
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting because for me, I'm switching jobs here. After I've worked in the same kind of work for a long time in a number of organizations, but the decision for me to change jobs really was sort of a little bit about that question, that I do sense that there is a special time in our country's history, and they come along every so often, and this is actually one of those. You know, as an organizer for years and you push for stuff, you realize it's very hard to push that ball up the hill. And, you know, I would think, God, I should have been around when the union movement was going on, the civil rights movement. I'm a little too young for both of those. And so you sit and you work. And I think part of it is you hone your skills as an organizer and you learn how to do it and you push and you fight hard all the time. But every now and then there's a wave of change that comes along. And then our job is to ride that wave. So I sort of feel like for 30 years I've been preparing for this. And I'm ready to ride the wave, and I think it's coming now in terms of what kinds of things are doable. Man, we're in such a mess. I think it's going to be very hard to see very much success in terms of advancing forward. But the flip of that is that, you know, in crisis is opportunity, and I just think that there's an opportunity here and that the American people are probably ready more than often to really try something different and to try and make some changes. So I do think it's great. I you know, as I was mentioning on my predictability stuff, I don't know if I can predict things, but I think there'll be real reform. I think Obama's committed to changing the energy policies and our consumption habits and upgrading the infrastructure. I mean, I think those things he talks about are very positive on the substantive side. Healthcare reform, I think, is likely. It'd be interesting to see how he tackles the entitlement programs, Medicare and Social Security. Those are going to be tough, and so I'm not sure what will happen on that. But the one thing, aside from the substantive issues, is he seems a president, and this is, you know, we have a community organizer as president, and I think in the campaign you saw that this is someone who also understands what role of organizing has, and so I just think he's aware of that, and we can't miss the opportunity to deliver. He can't do it. He's, you know, he's the president of the United States. He can only go so far. But if we can mobilize people, I think he's ready to take the steps and help bring the country along on that. So I think there's some real challenges ahead. And I think his commitment to sort of citizen involvement, the stuff he talks about for community service for college students, to just the idea of engaging in your community, It's very positive. The people who I work with for decades, there is an energy out there that I haven't felt in a long time. So I'm hopeful. I don't know specifically.
Mike, you mentioned changing jobs, and you start tomorrow as first day as director of the university. Why go from two organizations that you helped start that you've been director of to one that's so old? It's the oldest student organization on this campus. It's the oldest charity in this county. It's been going on 137 years. Why? What makes you? What attracts you about that kind of a position?
Well, it's weird. A lot of people have been asking me that, both in the interviews, but also just friends and stuff. And I wasn't looking for a job. I wasn't thinking I was going to change. I love the work that I do. I love Community Shares as an organization. And my wife happened to just point it out in the newspaper, and we started talking about it. And one of the things in the work that I've been doing, I've been doing community organizing for since about 77. I've worked in a community where there's this university and it has great potential and there's lots of students who want to be engaged. And I think, as I was saying a little earlier, I think more so now than in a long time. But I also came out of the university as a student and got involved in the community in ways that was unexpected. And I felt like I sort of stumbled into my career and my calling in some ways. And that really I've always wanted to build something, establish something that allowed for better use of getting students engaged in the community and for community groups to engage the university and how to tap into those resources. And so I would always see opportunities, but they seem limited. And I am sort of an entrepreneur. I like to build things, and I've been very involved in some groups and getting them started. And so this was sort of in the back of my mind, boy, that's something I really like to yet to tackle. With all the stuff that's been going on the last year and how young people are engaged, it's been more at the fore of my thinking. And as I get older, I think, what is there to pass on other than engaging a new group of students in the world around them? So all that sort of started coming together, and I thought about the why and its mission and its involvement and role in the university, and it seemed like an opportunity that was too hard to pass up. So at the end, I was just too excited, and I put my name in, and fortunately they decided I was the right person for the job.
Well, I know there were many exceptionally talented people who applied for the position, and the committee has chosen you, and I'm just delighted to have this chance to talk. We have another caller on the line. Let me give the numbers again for others who'd like to join the conversation with Mike Doyle and our new WILL intern, Carly Nix, who's also asking questions. 333-9455 if you're in the Champaign-Urbana area. If it's a long distance, call 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to line number one. You're on Keeping the Faith. Go ahead.
Good afternoon.
Hi.
I'm calling to ask your thoughts based on all the years you've been involved in not-for-profit organizations on how best to have a mix of full-time paid, part-time paid, but some professional staff, and a lot of people who are willing, eager, but obviously need some help, as volunteers. I recently had a chance to hear a presentation by a community organizer for the healthcare consumers, and it shocked me a little bit. I just didn't realize, with all I hear about their need for volunteers, that to get anything really done, you need at least one or a few people to keep things going constantly on the professional level. So I'm just wondering, now that you've got a new position, you can look back on what you've been involved with and think ahead of what you're entering on, and talk a bit about this need for a mix of full-time continuity with staff and volunteers of various levels of experience. Thank you.
Great. Thanks for the question.
Great question. I mean, I'm kind of an organizational geek person, so I love how organizations grow and develop. The question of staffing and building nonprofits and volunteer efforts, the Champaign County Healthcare Consumers, which started in 77 and it's now 32 years old, when we started it, it was a group of people meeting in their living rooms talking about a specific thing that they cared about and wanting to do something about that. There wasn't really a thought that we would be around here 32 years later. And it grew and it developed as an organization. It eventually got staff. And I think it's great example of an organization that organizes people, brings them together, wins some victories, and is able to somehow institutionalize their existence so that it alters the relationships of power, so that today there's still a consumer voice around health issues in this community, unlike almost any other community in the country. And I'm sure there's some out there, but there's very few. And so that when healthcare providers are doing things in the community, there is a voice for consumers and a place for them to go to have their concerns addressed. And I think that is only possible because the organization was built and has an institutional support, has lots of dues-paying members and raises money, gets a lot of support in the community. So I think that's a great example of why it's important to have that. But you know, the other thing that happens to organizations as they grow from these volunteer efforts is that they become institutions, and institutions are driven by the thought of stability. And so sometimes they lose that focus and that push for that. So it can have a downward effect. And then I've been involved in, you know, dozens, if not more, efforts of citizens just coming together around stuff and wanting to address it, you know, a dump site near their home out in Carroll Addition a couple of decades ago, or just little issues in their community, and they come together and they go away. And I think that's also incredibly valuable.
The problem goes away.
Yeah, they win. And that's why they came together and they accomplished it. You know, some you have neighborhood groups and the issues will change. Now let's go get a stop sign. Let's go there. I think we have to be open, accept the fact that it doesn't always have to be this getting it bigger, getting it better, getting it stronger. I think there's a lot of value in that. So I started with the example of why that's important to be able to do. But I think also we have to value the involvement in trying to change stuff. And sometimes it leads to organizations and sometimes it doesn't. And organizations have give and take and flow. And there's a great group, United Citizens and United Neighbors and Citizens, United Citizens and Neighbors, sorry, UCAN, that has had staff at times. It's a volunteer effort, and it's just average folks, and they're struggling to get by and pay the bills, but they also care about their neighborhood, and so they come together, and it isn't staff. And I think it's the drive of the people to keep going to meetings and doing stuff is a real testament to them. And I think it'd be a mistake to always say, hey, where's your staff? Why can't you do this stuff? Because that isn't necessarily the best.
What sustains you when things get really tough and it looks like a group is not going to win? What keeps you going when it's tough to raise money, when it's tough to get volunteers, and when you're not making any seeming progress?
Yeah. Well, and I think there's a big part of who I am and maybe part of my ability to keep doing this is that I have a wonderful family. And so that's real important. My wife and I will be celebrating our 30th wedding anniversary this year, so we've had a great life together. And that's where I really get the support and the ability to, you know, deal with all the crises that come up on any different levels. And then I have four wonderful sons. And so that's really the place for me where I can replenish the energy and stuff like that. In terms of professionally, I think it is important to be around other people and to talk to them and share some of that because, you know, you don't always bring that home to your family in a way where they can help you think through a particular issue. So I think you have to have some support among your peers, and that's important. But for me, the family is probably where I get a lot of that.
When you mentioned you graduated from the University of Illinois, then you got into this kind of work, but is this what you were trained for, what you were thinking about doing? What did you study when you were an undergrad?
I came here to the University of Illinois to get my bachelor's degree in urban planning, which I successfully did. I think I got my degree in 79. You know, and it's almost embarrassing to say, and I'm, you know, but it's the truth of this, and it says a little bit about me. When I was trying to pick my major coming to the university, I was transferring. I had done a couple of years doing nothing and wasting my life away and decided to go back to college. I picked urban planning here, partly because I thought, oh, cities and everything. But I was really determined to go to law school and, you know, use the law to bring about change. I was terrible at a foreign language, and you didn't have to have a foreign language in urban planning, I'm sorry to say, because it wasn't the College of Fine Applied Arts. So as embarrassing as that is, that ended up being my career. Now, urban planning
I can sympathize. I was terrible at foreign
it's
language.
It's a shame. But the urban planning, you know, again, you wouldn't think community organizing and change and stuff like that. But, you know, really the urban planning is about making these decisions, you know, highways, neighborhoods, zoning. And, you know, so you're learning this stuff. And one of the questions that comes up is, you know, who should decide these things? Because with all those decisions, there's winners and losers. Some people benefit from a zoning change. Some people are going to hurt by it. Some people, you know, it'll be great to have this new expressway take me out to the suburbs where I live. And other people, hey, that's going to tear down my neighborhood and my home. So planners are dealing with really political decisions. And the ability to come up with the right decision, we all believe, is, well, we have to hear everyone's viewpoint. Inevitably, power makes those decisions. And people are left out. And so does the planner have an obligation to have those voices heard? You know, should poor people be heard? How do we get them involved? How do we make sure that they're hearing? Do we hold a hearing? Is that enough? And then the question is, well, they need to be more organized, because these guys, these developers are real organized, and these people over here have their interests. These people are being, you know, left out of this thing, and it's because they're not organized. So there's this whole debate in urban planning, is that a legitimate part of the planning process, and what's the role of the planner? Eventually, you cross over the line and you become a community organizer, and you're outside of the planning model. But that's sort of where I came from, and it was out of that and that whole idea of bringing about change and using engagement of people through community organizing is really what turned me on.
Where do your values come from? Why do you care?
You know, I was brought up in Irish Catholic from the south side of Chicago, so we had a lot of politics around us all the time. But also, you know, we were sort of a liberal Catholic family. You know, in the 60s, we were having mass being said in our living room with priests who were there, you know, liberal priests, the Barragan type, the Jesuits. And so I was exposed to a lot of social justice talk and issues around those times. My parents eventually divorced. My mom remarried and married a Jesuit priest who worked with Saul Alinsky in Chicago and the Barragan brothers in New York. So, you know, I'm in high school and he's telling me these stories and I'm hearing this stuff, and I don't think I quite appreciate at the time where I was in the matrix. But that was sort of there. But again, when I came to University of Illinois, I was going to be a lawyer and, you know, do good stuff, but I was going to be a lawyer. And once I realized and I heard this, the idea of what the decisions and how they get made, you know, you can change things through the law. You can file lawsuits and stuff like that. But what you lack with that is empowering people. You know, I've seen a lot of groups who raise money, let's hire a lawyer, and we're going to pay the lawyer. And then the lawyer goes off to take the bad person to court. And then people sit back and they wait, and they're totally disempowered. And then rulings go against them, or their lawyer makes a mistake, or the other side has more resources. And it's like, I can't fight City Hall. I can't do this. And, you know, so that's in some ways a very disempowering, although I think a legitimate way to change things sometimes. With community organizing, what got me so engaged was it's really about involving people in their community around these issues, and people get empowered by that, and they feel stronger, and they have control over their life. And to me, that's part of the reward. Even when you lose trying to change something, seeing people become empowered about their lives is also a very powerful experience.
We're talking on Keeping the Faith today with Mike Doyle, the brand new executive director of the University YMCA here at the University of Illinois. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for these programs every Sunday night from 5 to 6, and I have the pleasure of talking with some fascinating people over the years. I was the former director at the Y for 9 years after having been a Presbyterian pastor at McKinley Church and Foundation on campus, so I've been around the university for quite a while, and I'm looking forward to talking with Mike during the second half of this program about how he hopes to engage the student generation of this time. And we have a good example of one of those in the studio with us today, Carly Nix, who just graduated from Boston University, who is a WILL intern just beginning this week too. So we'll be hearing from both Carly and Mike in just a minute. But let me say a few things about some of the guests who will be coming up here on Keeping the Faith in the weeks ahead. Next week, we'll be talking with Jonathan Vanderbrug from the Health Care Justice group in Chicago by phone. Michael Zimmerman, who is a dean at Butler University in Indiana, will be our guest February 15, talking about evolution in relation to faith. February 22nd, our guest will be Jerry Sturmer from Voices for Children. And then in March, we'll be talking to some fascinating people, Robert Jones, Juan Cole, and others. So those are guests ahead on Keeping the Faith. Support for these programs is provided in part by the University YMCA that has employed both me and is now employing Mike Doyle. coming up at the Y this Tuesday is a Know Your University lecture. February 3rd, Scott Althaus, professor of political science communication, will be talking along with Kalev Litaru from the Klein Center for Democracy, talking about the way the Bush White House has quietly deleted or modified key documents in the public record and how difficult it's going to be for historians in the future to evaluate the Bush administration because of this. So that's a lecture and time for question and answer at noon at the Y, February 3rd, 1001 South Wright Street in Champaign, right across from Lincoln Hall. That's Tuesday. On Friday, there's another free lecture as part of the Friday Forum series. February 6th, Michael Louis, professor of computer engineering, will be talking about the ethics and social responsibility for scientists and engineers, thinking of suggesting ways to encompass stewardship for society and the environment as part of what they think about as engineers and as scientists. And coming up this Wednesday night at the Unitarian Universalist Church on Green Street in Urbana will be an interfaith panel sponsored by a Muslim group, the Intercultural Friendship Foundation. It's a panel talking about the prophets and saints from various religious traditions. That's at 7 o'clock at the Unitarian Universalist Church on Green Street in Urbana this coming Wednesday night. Well, let's get back to our guests here on Keeping the Faith. And let me give the phone numbers again for people who'd like to call in. Anywhere the program is heard, you may use a toll-free number, including if you're listening on the Internet. Anywhere in the continental U.S., you may dial 1-800-222-9455. In Champaign-Urbana, there are three lines you can access by punching in 333-9455. And incidentally, if you've missed part of this program or other programs in the past, they are archived at the winlwill.illinois.edu website. You can go to AM and then check under Keeping the Faith or type in a name or a topic on a search engine. And if we've had a program on that topic, you can hear the program at your convenience via your computer. So that's will.illinois.edu and then AM. Well, we're talking with Mike Doyle. Mike, I was wondering about students. Yeah. You've had college students involved in your various projects. Of course, many students are concerned with healthcare issues and other things that you've been an activist about. But what's the present generation like? What are your hopes for them? How do you hope to engage them?
Yeah. Well, you know, again, that's part of my attraction to deciding to make the career change. You know, I feel like I still have a lot to learn about that. Four sons, three of them are in their 20s, and, you know, I can see them and their friends and how they're engaged in the world is different from how you and I have been engaged in the world. In some ways, it's much more wired and networked than I think we have experienced. And I think that's one of the challenges for someone in my position is to be able to begin to understand that, because I do think it's different, and it does change how you interface with one another. You know, I think 100 years ago, as civic organizations were being developed, the League of Women Voters, NAACP, organizations like that, it was a different time. And I think we're seeing 100 years later where how we're organized and how we're connected and how people are engaged in the world around them in the community is going to be different from how it has been. I think it was, you know, it was very top-down organizations, and you felt an obligation to participate and to be involved and sort of expected of you. And I think today people are looking for more meaning in some of the stuff, in not needing the same kind of organizational structures as we do. You know, how they interact with the news, how they interact with change, how they participate in stuff, and the initiatives that they take, it's a very personal experience. And so I think there are some challenges there, both understanding that, and I think there's a lot of exciting stuff going on. The Obama campaign captured some of that on some level. And again, this is not my area of expertise, but I think so part of it is making sure we're understanding that and looking for ways to engage students in the world the way they're engaging the world themselves. Because I think sometimes the organizations that I was around 20, 30 years ago, you know, mailing out flyers is not the right way to always do it. We still think in those terms sometimes.
Sure.
So I think that's one of the challenges on it. You know, I think one of the exciting parts of it is that I think students are hungry to engage the world in a way that, you know, I think every generation feels that way in some way. But this, and I don't know how to explain it necessarily. I don't know if I completely understand it. But so I think it's how do you channel that? How do you capture it in a way so that, you know, over the years, there's some basic principles of organizing and bringing people together. And I want to be able to share those and learn from people and figure out how we put it together. But so it's how do you continue to build that infrastructure? And I think how do you take advantage of it? Again, I think there's sort of this wave coming. And the more we're prepared for it, the more we're engaging and organizing to address that. So how do we effectively engage students in the things that they care deeply about is going to be the challenge. But I think unlike the past 15 or 20 years, there are going to be more energy than there's been there in the past.
We're fortunate to have Carly Nix in the studio, who just graduated from Boston University. During your years there, Carly, coming from Illinois, you were out in that wonderful city for college students. Was there anything that pulled you away from classes enough to volunteer for things, to get involved in any activities or issues?
Oh, you know, NPR. we have a few different NPR affiliates and stations in Boston. So I volunteered my time as the station administrator for my radio station in college. And then I volunteered at some other stations in Boston. So that was the number one thing that I was doing.
Uh-huh. And as you look at your generation, people who are in school with you, what tended to appeal to them? What would get them out of their sort of social rut or just focusing on college and fun?
Well, you know, I think that I don't know. I think that my generation is different in that the different new medias have sort of isolated people, you know, with iPods and cell phones and the internet and everything. There was a period of readjustment after all of those came to be. And I think that people started to, you know, like not talk to each other as much on the streets and have the same sort of community as there used to be. But I think that we might hopefully be getting into a period of time where we'll be adjusted to that and know how to reconnect with communities with each other. So I'm hoping that that's going to be something that will change in the future. But I know my uncle was saying, he's a fireman, and he said that he remembers when people used to come out on the street and help direct traffic whenever the fire trucks were coming to, you know, work on a fire, and people don't do that sort of stuff anymore. So I think that the changes in media and technology have had something to do with that.
It's interesting that people of your generation, if a community organizer like Mike, a social activist, is trying to even get the attention of a young person, they have to be aware that there's some barriers that they're going to have to get through, like the fact that they may always be listening to their own music collection on their own ears. So I think it does create some new challenges, but also new opportunities, as you were saying, Mike. The Obama campaign found out that, boy, online you could sure communicate with a lot of people pretty quick.
Right. Well, and I think, you know, what in some ways I think the principles of why people get involved is it makes some difference in their lives, right? I mean, and, you know, when you're organizing a neighborhood around a housing issue or, you know, expressways coming through, what people, you know, I think there's this sense of community organizing that it's a protest because that's what makes it on the TV. You're an organizer. Oh, so you organize protests, right? And I think that's sort of and that's how they know us. Oh,
well, that's
people
the Saul Alinsky model, rub raw the sores of discontent.
But, you know, the first principle of Alinsky is that, you know, you have to make concrete improvements in people's lives. So if the tactics of protest are just one of the many, hopefully, that you're using to really change people's lives. And so really it's the first thing that we're always interested in is what's the improvement you made? I remember watching this thing and it was the perfect sort of wrong approach to organizing was protesting, which was, this was in the 80s and Reaganomics, and they went into Pennsylvania and the coal country was hurting. And so they went to this organization, they followed him around, and he threw red paint on some corporate executive and, you know, indicating that the people's lives are being hurt by blood. And the 60-minute person says to them, you know, well, why do you do that? And he says, well, he doesn't realize he's making people's lives miserable, so we're going to make his life miserable. And I don't know if that's what that guy believed, but what a waste. I mean, This is not about making people's lives miserable. This is about lifting people up. And so good organizing is, you know, you're getting a stop sign there because it's a safety issue. You're saving houses. So if people get involved for the purpose of making change, there has to be some real concrete improvements there. And I think that's one of the things, you know, the idea of compromise. So it isn't just about protesting. And I think people need to understand that in terms of engaging people. And I think once people, you know, I think people, what they're hungry for is they want to see something better. They want to make it better. I mean, I think we all have that. And the question is, how do you capture that energy in a way and apply it so that it does make concrete improvements in people's life, so it does give them a sense of their own power, and it does alter the relationships of power so that, we don't have the same kind of relationships between the wealthy and the poor, and that there's a, you know, there's more equity in the system and there's more balance in the system. So to me, those principles of organizing, I think, will apply to young people, and that's, you know, part of my stick.
A lot of different political ideologies appeal to students these days. You're liable to run across as many libertarians as you are conservative Republicans.
Right.
Across that spectrum, there's just so many. Do you have to sort of plan different attacks to involve them, different approaches, or?
I don't think so. I mean, again, I think, you know, what people value and what they want to see, what changes that they want, whether it's very conservative or very liberal or libertarian, that's what's going to drive them. And the question really is, do we as people entering a whole new age, I mean, there is a new synergism. When you were talking earlier, Carly, about the technology, and it seemed to isolate people, because I think there's now a sense that it can bring people together in a way that we hadn't thought of. And So how that all does, is it society adjusting to those changes and now figuring it out and how to use this to our advantage? I think back 100 years ago and all the impact of industrialization was hitting cities and sort of breaking apart, tearing the fabric of society apart, and society sort of reorganized itself in ways to sort of build that structure back in, that may be some of what we're experiencing now. But I think the basic premises of how people get engaged and what kind of citizens we're going to be and what our role as citizens, I think, is less important. And sort of irrelevant in terms of where you fit on the political spectrum. You know, to me, it's better to be engaged and care about the world. There will be differences, and that's okay. I mean, I think it'd be wrong to think that there's only one right way to look at the world. It's the engagement of people that's exciting.
Now, you've just left two organizations that you helped start, Healthcare Consumers, and then for the last 10 years, Community Shares of Illinois. Can you really leave them? Here you've got this new position, a new organization, but you helped start them. They're your babies. How do you abandon them?
Yeah. Well, it's always a challenge. Although those are probably two of the more successful organizations I've been involved with, I've been involved in lots of organizations, many of which are no longer around. So you sort of learn how to deal with the grief that comes with losing an organization. And sometimes the grief is more difficult when it dies and you think, this is a great organization and now it's not going to be around anymore. There's just not the leadership or whatever. So walking away when they're successful is a little bit easier in that sense. For the healthcare consumers, although we share offices with them, I haven't really been on the board or involved in any direct way in probably, 7, 8, 9, 10 years. So it's been a while. Uh-huh. And I've been able to disengage. And it's actually – that's the greatest feeling, is to see that organization and Claudia Lenhoff, who's the executive director now and has been for a while, and there's been previous executive directors, to see them be able to run and build the organization, take it new directions. And I feel like with Community Shares, someone else coming in brings a different skill set, a different eye to the organization. The organization will be stronger because of that, and that's really what I want it to be. So I think it'll be good for the organization and me.
Let me ask you a question that someone hoped that I would ask you who wasn't able to be calling in this today. What do you do with an organization that dies that should have continued, like the Urban League?
Right.
Here they had horrible problems financially. Can there be a resurrection? Can they ever come back?
Well, in my comments earlier a little bit is I – few organizations survive forever, and rarely do they survive in the same form. I mean, if you look at the University Y 135 years ago and where they are today.
Very different.
And they've gone through changes. And I think one of the great things about the Y and its history is its ability to evolve, to address different issues, to be, you know, listen to the community and be able to respond to that and to be proactive about addressing things. So I think that's such an important thing to maintain an organization. And organizations that successfully do that for, you know, long periods of time is a testament to the leadership and people involved in it. But sometimes organizations live out their life and they go away and it is a loss, but they've had their mark. And so, you know, sometimes it just happens. Sometimes it's bad leadership does it. Sometimes it's a variety of things. It's the environment that they're operating in. And, it's tough things. And I hats off to the people who are able to do it. And when we lose an organization, I don't know if you go back and try and recreate that. I think if there's a need there, people will figure out whether it's the Urban League again or the community that was served by the Urban League, that need grows up from the bottom. And I think, you know, the question of someone before about staff versus volunteer, I think some of the strongest organizations, you look around, they all sort of grow out of sort of citizens coming together around some need, seeing it. You know, Burnham Hospital, who was here for years, grew out of, it was, you know, a public hospital meeting the needs of the community, and it had changed and everything, and then it went away. And it was a loss, and a lot of us who cared about that as an institution saw it as a loss in the community, but life does go on, and new organizations grow up to meet the need. So I think if you step back and look at it as more organic and that it has its own life, that it's not as painful maybe when an organization closes. It just may have been the time.
What are some success stories that you've been a part of in terms of community organizing that you use to motivate people to get involved in community activism?
Yeah. One of them, it sort of explains, I think, a little bit of how people don't understand community organizing, but this goes back a long way. Mercy Hospital, which is no longer around either, although Provena's, it's more recent evolution. There was a period when Mercy Hospital back in 79 was denying Medicaid recipients or charging Medicaid recipients for bills that they were getting, and they weren't supposed to do it. They were supposed to take payment from the state as payment in full. And instead, when the state would pay their $50 on the $150 bill, they'd send the balance to the recipient. And this had been going on for a while. The people who I knew who knew about it were at Public Aid who were complaining about it, and they just couldn't get their supervisors to, you know, put pressure on the hospital to stop doing it. And so we were working in the community and hearing this story about it. And so it was, well, what do we do? And people started meeting, eventually got a meeting with the president of the hospital, confronted him with it. He claimed he knew nothing about it, which I actually believe. It was just an issue that was sort of being down in the bowels of the hospital, and it's not hearing the voice of the people who were negatively affected by it. Public Aid, people ultimately didn't care about it. You know, the hospital hierarchy wasn't hearing about it. If a legal aid used to take people into the hospital and say, can you get this taken off of, you're not supposed to be charging this, and then the hospital would drop the charge. But it never systematically changed. And when people got together, had this meeting with the president of the hospital, it was a bit confrontational, but it was this meeting that was very intense. And the president said, you know, we wouldn't be doing this. He pointed to the crucifix and said, we run our institution. As if he was running our institution, I don't believe we're doing this. He went back, found out that they were. A couple of days later, they changed the policy. I honestly believe that they didn't know it. It wasn't intentional, but it was never getting addressed until it got to his attention. And the people in the room, there were about 50 or 60 people, suddenly this guy who they never got to interact with before, they're meeting with him, and they're saying, and there were some angry, I remember Mamie Smith sort of stood up at that meeting and took over, and she was a leader for a long time. And she sort of confronted him, and she never had that opportunity. When that policy changed in 2 days, Mamie Smith knew she was the reason that it changed. Not that a lawyer might not have been able to do it, but she did it. And the women in the room who were there felt that. And they went on, and that was one of the big first victories of the healthcare consumers. And it built this reputation in the community as if you've got a problem and you can't get it solved, let's come together and do that. And so that, to me, was a good example of it. We were criticized by some people because why were you, you know, it was something like consumers, you know, attack president of the hospital.
That's the way it was reported.
Yeah, that was the headline of the paper the next day, and it's so depressing. And a lot of people who had been supported in the organization hadn't been involved in this particular issue. They were more middle-class people at the university. And I remember this meeting, and we're coming together, and someone said, well, why did you do that? You know, why didn't someone – Mike, you should have called Mr. Aldrich on the phone and said, hey, Ron, this is going on, and, you know, you should stop it because we'll do something. And my response, although I probably would handle a little bit differently if I had done this, we might have given him the chance, and he might have said yes or no, but we probably didn't give him the chance he should have gotten, was that, you know, if I would have done that, would have confirmed, yeah, well, you're Mike Dill, you're on TV, sure you can call the president of the hospital, and sure you can get it resolved. But I'm Mamie Smith, and I'm a Medicaid recipient, and I'm 65 years old, and I can't do that, so I can't change the world. You can change the world. And by doing this, you know, Mamie now believes that and understands, and in fact, she can and other people can. So it empowers them. And, it, you know, I think that's why that tactic becomes better than me making the phone call and seeing if I can get it resolved. So it's this issues like that. But there are literally hundreds. I'd love to sit here and tell some of the war stories of things that we've won. I was involved in a neighborhood group in my neighborhood. I live in North Urbana. When the hospital was trying to expand, tear down housing, we were able to save housing, get money invested into the neighborhood. And then there was also a medical waste incinerator that we help shut down and stuff like that. So there's been a lot of things, although maybe too boring for everyone to listen to now.
Not at all. It's fascinating. We're talking with Mike Doyle on Keeping the Faith this afternoon on WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD2 and HD3 Urbana, broadcasting service of the College of Media at Illinois. Mike is the new executive director of the university YMCA at the university campus here at Illinois. He starts full-time tomorrow, so you can, if you have questions, stop by and see him at 1001 South Wright Street or give him a call at, let's see, I used to know that number, 337-1500, right?
That's right.
Area code 217. And we also have in the studio today Carly Nix, our new WILL intern, recent graduate of Boston University. If you'd like to call in, 333-9455. We still have 5 or 6 minutes. We could get in a couple callers. Or 333-9455, locally 1-800-222-9455 if it's a long-distance call. Mike, you mentioned some of the local groups that through Community Shares of Illinois you've helped fund. Are there any in particular that you really felt good about because you were able to help them in a way that they hadn't been able to help themselves?
You know, as someone in my work, I always feel like, well, I don't want to take credit for helping someone when they couldn't help themselves because I'm such a believer that we can all do it. So I wouldn't say it would be in that they couldn't do it themselves, but I guess groups that I feel good about to be able to participate in terms of their support. You know, I have a real affinity for groups and, you know, again, at least groups that I've been engaged with, they've been starting. So like WEFT Radio, which is a local radio station here in town, to me is a wonderful organization. It's small. And I'm Mick Wolf, who's the staff person. There's an amazing person for the amount of work that he does in keeping that organization going. So And so I think through Community Shares, you know, they're probably getting in $10,000. I'm making a rough amount of a budget that's probably only $100,000. So it's a significant part of their budget.
Sure.
And that feels really good to do that. And it's really a grassroots supported organization, and it's volunteers and stuff like that. So there's something about that that I know gets my interest in drawing. But I feel good about – I don't know. I like a lot of the groups. IMC is a new organization the last few years.
Independent and, Media Center.
Right, right, which is – so – you can see I have a little affinity for those kinds of organizations. But, you know, some of the groups that get the most support here do wonderful work, like the Champaign County Humane Society. People love the animals, and they love, you know, making their lives better also. And Habitat for Humanity is an organization. I'm trying to think, am I forgetting other groups who are local members?
Sure.
And I don't mention them. But
sure.
As an organization, you know, when we started Community Shares, you know, for years I've been an organizer, and one of the challenges with small nonprofits is how do you sustain it? How do you keep raising money and stuff like that? And workplace giving is one of the best ways to do it. So the idea of bringing organizations together to help identify and build a way to sustain them over a long period of time was an interesting and exciting thing.
Now, because this is a university radio station, we have a lot of people at the university who, of course, are regular listeners. I know that from the comments they make and the calls they make. How do they decide out of the various options they have? They can give to United Way, they can give to Community Shares, they can give to the Federated program. How do you suggest people think about all that? There used to be very few right. charities in well, the community, you know, and now there are hundreds.
Well, and I think this is this in some of the one of the underlying themes of our conversation is the world's changed. Yeah. And in the old days, you gave to one United Fund, and they decided where your money goes. You know, here it is. You're best to know what to do with it. Today, you literally, at most workplaces or many workplaces, you can pick from 500 different charities.
Yeah.
And you're empowered to make that decision, and you get to direct it. And so, you know, there's no one advice other than you should give to what you care passionately about, and you should give generously, because these organizations do great work, and whatever you believe in is really the way it should go.
I know that some people are hesitant to donate to organizations because they don't know where the money is going to go. What would you say to people who have those concerns?
Yeah. Well, I mean, one, get to know the organizations that you're going to support. So I think it's important to do that. You know, you get that long list. I'd be hesitant about just picking a group that you see the 15-word description in there and, oh, that sounds good. So I do think people should be engaged in the organizations, and I think there's value beyond money. But, you know, most organizations, they have a web page there. You should go visit the web page, check them out, find out what you can. You can now, through a GuideStar.com, go online and get their 990. So you can actually see every nonprofit has to file a 990, which tells their income and expenses and stuff like that. So there's actually, without a lot of work, an ability to find a fair amount of information about organizations.
And with the 990, you can even get the executives' pay. You can see
absolutely.
how much
the highest paid people in the organization, how much they spend on fundraising, how much they spend on program.
Sure.
So, a lot of people don't do that, but it's there. And I think that increases the accountability. You know, those of us who have managed nonprofits and, you know, want to do the best practices, you know, I think that's a really good thing that people can check it out and see what they see.
So what's the first thing you're going to do your first 100 days? You only have 60 seconds to tell us.
I'm doing a lot of listening and learning. You know, I mean, I don't come in with a set of, here's what we're going to do, folks. They got a great staff there. You've done a wonderful job in your tenure. So the organization is strong. The staff's doing great work. For me, it's going to be a learning period, listening to a lot of people. I really want to get out in the community, at the university, and get to know the students and try and expose myself so that at least as I take a leadership role within the organization, I'm doing it to reflect where everyone wants to take it.
And people who've known you for years and respected you as a social activist in this community, if they want to give money to the university, why, just on the fact that you're going to be there helping with it, how can they do that?
Well, I think that they can actually go to the website. They can send an email to me. I feel like I might not know all the right mechanisms, and Becca may question me. But I think my email now is mike@universityymca.org. So you can send me an email there, and I'll get back to you immediately, and we'll figure out how to do it. Becca is also
Becca Guyette, Director of Development, and Casey Umland, who's the program director. And there's just some great folks there. And the website for the University YMCA is universityymca.org, so it's easy to find. I want to thank Mike Doyle for talking with us about his past and his hopes for being director of the Y, the oldest student organization on this university campus, started just 6 years after the university began. Started out as a Protestant Christian group and soon grew to include everyone. And so it's now open to people of any faith or of none, and a lot of opportunities for volunteering, for tutoring, for doing service projects and social action. So I commend Mike Doyle for his wise choice in saying yes when they ask him to be the director. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for these programs. I've been happy to introduce today Carly Nix, our new intern, helping here and also at WILL-TV. You'll be hearing her voice from time to time on the air, as well as the help she'll be providing, arranging for guests for the program. Coming up next week on Keeping the Faith, our guest will be Jonathan Vanderbrug from Chicago, talking about health care justice in the state of Illinois. I remind you that Friday Forum continues at the University Y this Friday, February 6th, talking about ethics and social responsibility for scientists and engineers. And this coming Tuesday at noon, Scott Altos talking about airbrushing history, American style. Also, Kalev Litaru will be the guest Tuesday at the University Y. Thanks for listening to Keeping the Faith.